This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Today we bring you a special hour of Radio Boston. It's the latest of our conversations in the WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. The series features in-depth conversations with women who have broken ground as leaders in fields traditionally dominated by men, from the arts to biotech to venture capital. Next up, journalism, as we talk with Eileen McNamara and Margaret Sullivan. Eileen McNamara started at the Boston Globe as a secretary, working her way up through the newsroom to become a columnist, for which she won a Pulitzer Prize in 1997. She's now a professor emerita of the journalism program at Brandeis University. Margaret Sullivan began at the Buffalo News as an intern. She worked her way all the way up to become the paper's first female editor. Then she joined the New York Times in 2012, becoming the first woman to hold the position of public editor there. In 2016, she became the media columnist at the Washington Post. And she's also just released a memoir, Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. Careers full of striving, defying expectations, and sometimes frustration and even threats.
As I was writing columns that had nothing to do with gender or being a woman, I would be attacked on social media, but also, you know, through phone calls, email, even in person, in a very sexualized, a very gender-driven way.
Margaret's experiences, not unique, but sometimes, as Eileen noted, the discrimination was silly enough to be a little funny.
When I went to the Washington Bureau, I didn't have a desk, an office. Everybody else had an office, and all the other reporters. And there was a young man in one of the offices, and he was a correspondent for the paper. He wasn't on staff. So I said to the bureau chief, well, do you think we could ask him maybe to sit in the hall here where you've put a desk for me? Because I'm having this experience that's happening every day, which is when the FedEx man comes, who do you think he goes to? And I said, you know, he's a very nice man, but I don't want to keep signing for FedEx envelopes.
As we always do with Phenomenal Women, though, we started much earlier. I asked Margaret Sullivan when she first remembered defying expectations as a girl.
I think in high school, I really wanted to go to a big fancy college like my brothers were going to, in Massachusetts, actually, even though I was in Buffalo. And my parents, you know, I mean, they had the idea that girls were a little different and they didn't really need to go to MIT or Holy Cross or something like that. And so they wanted me to keep me close to home. And I did go to Le Moyne College, which I have only good things to say about. It's a Jesuit school. But the whole time I was there, I was plotting to, you know, go someplace bigger in a bigger city. And I ended up at Georgetown. And I think I had to fight against my family's expectations and my mother's expectations, frankly, to show that, yeah, I could be just as treated the same way as my older brothers.
And did your mom eventually embrace it?
Well, they sent, you know, they paid the tuition, so I guess so. But, you know, I sometimes joke about this, that my mother, you know, my mother had a fabulous early career before she was married as a department store buyer. She was a buyer for Better Dresses, which always made me wonder what the other dresses she described as. But she quit when she got married, you know, and so there was always that tension, you know, what's a girl supposed to be like? What's a girl supposed to do and be? And I don't think that I got the answer from her. I had to figure that out on my own.
Your turn, Eileen. First time you remember in your life defying expectations for a female.
Well, I'm not sure if it was because I was a female, but I guess we all start in high school. No one in my family had ever gone to college. So the expectation was that I wouldn't go either. And I never would have gone to college, as though I wanted to, if it weren't for a high school English teacher. I went to a little high school that no longer exists. It was called North Cambridge Catholic High School, and surprisingly, it was in North Cambridge. And it was a really small school, and some people did go to college. Lots of people went to BC Nursing School and to Regis, lots of Catholic colleges. But my father didn't think that that was a wise choice. So this English teacher, amazingly enough, she was only in Cambridge because her husband was getting his PhD in physics at Harvard. And So she took me under her wing. She only taught there for a year, but I became her babysitter. And when it came time to apply for colleges, she handed me the application to Barnard in New York, which, of course, I'd never been out of North Cambridge, so I didn't even know what it was or where it was. And she said, she gave me the $5 to fill out the application. And the funniest part of this story is I then went to the Sister Margaret Ann, who was the college counselor at North Cambridge Catholic, which wasn't a tough job since not many people went to college, and asked her if she had a catalog for Columbia. And she asked me why I wanted to go to school in South America.
She was the college counselor. Mm. Wow.
I couldn't make that one up. Oh my gosh. So I guess that defied expectations.
And does she know? Does she know that she set you on a different path?
My English teacher?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. She just turned 80, and I saw her last summer when she lives out in California, and my daughter is working in San Francisco. So this was the first time I had an opportunity to introduce my daughter, Katie, to her. She's heard about her whole life.
Yeah.
Because she clearly did change my life.
Margaret, in reading your book, you are a very determined woman. And
a little driven.
Yeah. And you talk about that. Okay. So because you said that, we were going to go there later. We're going to go there right now. Mm-hmm. Because you talk about that. And it is very interesting the way that you lay out your determination as a woman. You're sort of head down, straightforward, get to the job that I want to get. And also the challenges of that as a mother, as a wife, as a mother. You tell a story in the book that still makes a bead of sweat run down my back, which is trying to use a plastic breast pump in a conversation, in a day where you have meetings with Ben Bradley from the Washington Post, and just remembering from my own experiences with, you know, a less friendly environment and trying to do that.
That was very stressful. I was at the Buffalo News at the time, but visiting the Washington Post and with basically a newborn baby staying with a friend in Northern Virginia. And I had to pump. And, you know, the only place there was to pump at the Washington Post, well, there really wasn't any place. So I just went into the ladies' room, into a stall. And, you know, it was actually really, it was a really long time ago. My son is a lawyer now. But I remember how completely stressed out I was and how literally impossible it was to do.
So I wanted to ask you, are you at peace with all of that?
Oh, with all of that? I've had a very, you know, I've had a lot of success as a journalist. My drivenness has gotten me places, and I'm actually now at a time when I'm trying to change my life a little bit. You know, I joked when I left my column at the Washington Post, which I could have done for forever, I guess, that it was like a self-imposed term limit. Which I actually think columnists, it's a good idea to, you know, Eileen and I were talking about this. After a while, you start writing the same column over and over. But now, you know, I'm going to teach, I'm going to write some fiction, and I'm going to try to have a little bit more balanced and a little bit more relaxed life, and we'll see if I'm actually able to do that.
And in general, because you thought what I was asking you was, are you at peace in general?
Yeah, well, I think, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. How about the rest of you guys?
So, Eileen, I want to, you know, we were talking in the green room beforehand. You also have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
And this question of breaking ground as a woman in a time when women were expected to have children, mm-hmm. Expected to be home with the children, or if not at home with the children, just figure it out. Mm. How do you think about that time now? And are you at peace?
Well, I'm not at peace. Okay. I'd probably never be at peace because I think that there were trade-offs that we had to make at the time that we came into journalism. you know, that I wish I hadn't had to make. I hope my son isn't here, because if he is, I don't want him to come up on the stage and tell you the compromises that they were. But I think it was very hard to do what we did in the culture of a newsroom, as it was when we were coming up, and have what anybody could think of as a kind of normal home life. You were always running, and it wasn't just deadlines. You know, I took the work home. I didn't cover the Boston Ballet. You know, I went to Columbine, mm-hmm. and when a classroom full of fifth graders in Dunblane, Scotland, were massacred, they sent me. So I have, I think we think differently about journalism now and what reporters experience. I always went on those assignments because I felt like I could never say no. No matter how difficult it might be emotionally to do those, I always felt that the institution was looking for an excuse to say that women won't go, they won't travel, they won't do that difficult story.
If you said no once, it might not come around again.
It might not come around again. So I always said yes. But it meant that I covered a lot of really difficult things, and I tried to leave it in the newsroom, but I know that I didn't. Mm-hmm. So... you bring, and there's no way that people talked about anything like trauma or the emotional
PTSD.
Toll. Yeah, that it takes on you to cover those kinds of stories. But it does take a toll on you. And I think I brought a lot of that into my house.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, so I want to stay on this subject a little bit longer. So in my career, my first leadership role, my kids were 2 and 5. And later I would say to people, I was angry for about 10 years because I could never be as good at any of the things I was responsible for as I knew I could be if it was the only thing I was responsible for. Mm-hmm. When, in that time when you were being pulled in so many different directions, when do you think you were at your most phenomenal, your most magnificent?
Well, I remember a moment when I was being named editor of the Buffalo News, which was a job that I had sought. I was the first woman to do it. I kind of got the job against the odds. There was a strong internal candidate who was a guy who was the favored candidate of the previous editor. There was a lot sort of going against me, but I did get it, and it was being announced at an outdoor event that was newspaper wide. And I remember that my daughter Grace was really little. I mean, she was 5 or 6. And she came up on stage with me when I went to speak to the assembled group, which was not just journalists, but, you know, the circulation people and the advertising people and all of that. And I remember she kind of, I have a photo of this, so maybe my memory is so affected by the photo, but she's kind of peeking out from behind my skirts a little bit, and she looks very curious and very confident, and I felt very lucky to have her there with me and to be maybe setting a good example for her and embracing this position that I had just gotten. And it got really tough after that, and you know, it did take a toll. I mean, I am divorced, and I think that I put my children's well-being up pretty high, but you know, it's hard to balance all that stuff, and my husband worked in the newsroom, so yeah. that added to it. So you know, I think there were moments when I felt things were pretty glorious, but what there weren't were times when I said, well, you know, I'm sure it would be wiser and better for me to just be a little more mellow. That just wasn't who I was.
So I'll stay with a follow-up for you, and then I'll go back to Eileen, because we have an audience member. You say you're driven, but that can be interpreted a number of ways in male-dominated industries. How was your ambition interpreted in the newsroom? That's the question from the audience member.
Well, I mean, in some people thought that it was unseemly, you know, that it in fact, I remember an older woman reporter saying to someone else in the newsroom, you know, she's about me, she's very ambitious, you know, like this was some sort of sin or something. And I guess so, but, you know, you don't really hear people say that about men, or you didn't hear people say it about men. It was just like, yeah, they want to be successful. It wasn't like the scarlet letter. So I don't know. I guess it was perceived both as a strength in some ways, and as something kind of weird and scary in other ways.
Margaret Sullivan is a former newspaper editor and columnist for the Buffalo News, New York Times, and Washington Post. Her new book is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. And Eileen McNamara was a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Boston Globe, now a professor emerita at Brandeis. Coming up, what it means to be an opinionated and maybe difficult woman. That's after the break. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. Listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. It's the latest in our series with WBUR City Space, Phenomenal Women. Margaret Sullivan and Eileen McNamara spent a career defying expectations in journalism, and they joined me on the City Space stage to talk about it. Sullivan was the first woman editor of the Buffalo News and went on to write for the New York Times and the Washington Post. Eileen McNamara broke basically every barrier to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning Boston Globe columnist in roughly three decades at the paper. We've talked about their childhoods and those early struggles for a foothold in a male-dominated newsroom. Now, how they tried to stretch the industry. And we start with Eileen recalling what it was like to make a living being something a lot of people couldn't abide, a woman with opinions. She was unapologetic for having them.
Well, I've never apologized for anything.
Fantastic.
So no, I never apologize for having opinions. And I would say I spent 20 years at the Globe as a reporter before I became a columnist, which I think saved my life as an opinion writer. I went in with a lot of confidence as an opinion writer because I knew what I was talking about. I'd been a reporter. You know, I started here covering the night police beat. I covered the State House. I covered Congress. You know, I wasn't young and untried. So that I think that helped a lot. But I used to keep this email that I got early on in my column writing career that came from a male reader who said that he had followed my reporting career at the Globe for those 20 years and admired my work. But he worried about me as an opinion columnist because he noticed that when I was at the State House, I wrote an awful lot about the Department of Social Services and not that much about administration and finance. So, you know, I was really leaning a little bit too much toward those women's issues. And he hoped that as a columnist that I would, you know, toughen up and write a little less about battered women and abused children. And not just domestic violence, but, you know, juvenile crime and things that I was just sort of naturally attracted to write about. And my response to him, I think, stands up. I told him, I'll write less about those things when my male colleagues start writing about them more. And I'm still waiting. So I think it's always been hard to be an opinionated woman in the world, not just in newsrooms. But without our voices, you see the stage to people who didn't necessarily do all the best things with the stage when they had it exclusively to themselves.
Margaret, how did you change the stage? As you emerged into leadership in Buffalo, how did you change the stage? Well, I love that analogy.
One thing I tried to do right away was to diversify the newsroom. to, because the newsroom that I inherited was about 3% non-white, and the city and the region were, you know, much more diverse. So I started, this was, you know, at a time when I could still hire, you know, it was before the sort of crash in which we had to start doing buyouts and layoffs and everything. So I was able to hire aggressively. And what I changed was the prerequisites that a reporter or an editor had to have before we would consider them as a candidate. You didn't necessarily, in my mind, have to have 3 to 5 years at, you know, in Binghamton or in Rochester or wherever it was, that I would look at people a little differently because I really, really wanted to change the makeup of the newsroom. And I don't mean that I lowered our standards. I just mean that I looked at people who had different kinds of backgrounds. And that was successful. And I'm very proud of having done that.
So when you say it was successful, clearly part of what you mean is you changed the diversity of the newsroom. Mm-hmm. How did it change the stories you told? How did it change the journalism, the reporting?
I mean, people always, you know, reporters are not, we talk about objectivity and there's a whole debate about whether that even exists, but reporters and writers and editors always bring their own experience to the table. And so when you have people who have lived, you know, as people of color, they have a different experience and they come up with different story ideas just naturally. They don't necessarily set out to, you know, cover the race beat or something, but they see the world differently. And so you get different kinds of stories.
Eileen, how would you rate the Globe on that?
How would I rate the Globe on diversity?
Yeah.
Well, we have a ways to go. I think every newsroom in the country has a ways to go. And I think we should broaden that conversation about diversity, too. I mean, I was at the Globe for 30 years, and we talked about it all the time. But I didn't see the needle moving a lot. Yes, we had more reporters of color, but we never had anything in proportion to the numbers in the city. Well, why is that? It isn't because there aren't people out there to take those jobs. And if that were true, that there weren't people, why don't we commit ourselves? Why didn't we commit ourselves 30 years ago to going into the Boston public schools and helping them set up newspapers, especially now with the internet where it's so easy, you don't have to print a physical newspaper, and teach them what journalism is and follow those kids. Follow them into college and bring them into the newsroom. I mean, all the big newspapers have internship programs. And it's wonderful. If you went to Princeton and Harvard, you'll be certain to get one of those internships. But I'd like to see the Boston Globe have its interns from Dorchester. Mm-hmm. And we should be invested in bringing kids along so that they're ready to come be interns at the Boston Globe.
So let's stay with the Globe because, you know, the Globe's just announced this week. Nancy Barnes, who is currently the chief news executive at NPR, will be the new editor, replacing Brian McGrory, first woman in the role. So just to put it in perspective, 13th editor in 150 years, first woman in the role. So sort of going down the line, Margaret to Eileen first, just reactions to that appointment, Margaret.
Well, I know Nancy Barnes, and she has a great background in newspapers. She'll be a good leader. She's very capable. She has the perfect background, I would say, for the job. And I would say that it's very refreshing and you know, necessary to not have, you know, only white men running such a powerful institution. So I applaud it. I think it's great.
And Eileen, first reactions?
I think it's great, and I think it's long overdue. And I think she'll be wonderful. But why did it take so long? There have been no women at the Boston Globe all these years. I mean, I was lucky to have a lot of mentors, older women at the Globe, who were phenomenal. There's going to be a new movie out next year about one of them, Loretta McLaughlin, who passed away not that long ago, and Loretta would be amused to find out that, you know, a very famous, beautiful actress is playing her in this movie, because Loretta was one of the first reporters in Boston to make the link during the Boston Strangler killings that there was one serial killer that was killing these women in the city. Loretta could have been the editor of the Boston Globe. She became the editor of the editorial page, But she was initially passed over for that job for a brilliant young man. He was brilliant and tragically died very young. And a good friend of mine, and I admired his work so much. But I don't think you could find a woman who worked at the Boston Globe in that era who didn't think that Loretta was passed over for that job and shouldn't have been. I think it takes a long time, and I'm glad that this day has arrived. But I can't help but note that newspapers are in their decline. And so the Washington Post now has a woman editor, and the Boston Globe has a woman editor. And you'll remember when people stopped watching broadcast news, women got to be on the anchor desk. There's a pattern here. When I first went to Capitol Hill to cover Congress, just by coincidence, the new reporter for the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, and Newsday, and the Boston Globe were all women. And as we set up our computers in the House Press Gallery, one of the congressional correspondents for the New York Times turned to us and said, "Well, there goes this beat. Now it's a pink ghetto." Oof. And he was a wonderful guy.
Sound like it, actually.
Whoa. Really? Because women have been assigned to this beat, it is suddenly devalued. I think we're seeing a little of that. And I wish her well, and she'll do a great job, I'm sure. She's got an incredible resume at the Boston Globe. But it's been a long time coming.
Let's do another audience question here. What are the most substantial, hard-to-see barriers that existed for women journalists when you both got started, and what about today? So then and now, Margaret.
Well, I think in my era, there was sort of a feeling that women should be covering certain kinds of beats or work in particular departments. So when I got my first big management job, it was unsurprisingly, I mean, I had been on the city desk, which was, you know, hard news. But when I was named an assistant managing editor, which is a step up the ladder, I was in the features department. The features department is like the softer part of the paper. It's the features. It's what used to be the women's section. So, you know, it was difficult for me to come out of this role in the features department and become managing editor of the paper, because it was kind of like, well, has she really done the serious work that, you know, if I had been the city editor, if I had been the national editor, whatever it was. So there's kind of that piece of it. I mean, I don't think there are huge barriers. I mean, I think there are pay equity issues. I know there are at many news organizations that women and people of color and women of color are just not paid as much, and it's documented. So that's still there. But I'm not sure about the, you know, I think in general you can move up in the organization more easily.
Although I do wonder, are we still missing the networks of mentors, the people who bring you up behind them, the role models that show you what you can imagine, especially for journalists of color in the news industry? Have we gotten there yet?
Well, it's happening, but it's, you know, it's slow. And, you know, for the longest time, you'd hear about the pipeline. Well, there's women and there's people of color, and they're going to be great when they run the paper. And they're in the pipeline right now, but the pipeline seemed to be very long and never ending.
Kind of to your point.
Yeah.
So same audience question to you. You know, the hardest barriers that you faced when you broke into the field, and what do you perceive those to be now?
Well, I think the culture at large has changed a lot since we started in journalism. It's not just newsrooms. I mean, it's most institutions, I think, were challenging when you began. There are things that editors said to me along the way, and I'm sure to you, Margaret, that would never get said today. There were decisions made about who could cover what that would never be made today because of fear of lawsuits, if nothing else. I can remember when I was in the Washington Bureau and Ted Kennedy was going to Ethiopia during the famine in 1984. That's how old I am. And I came home to Boston on the weekend. I was commuting back and forth remarkable as that was, and learned that they were sending a reporter from Boston with the senator to Ethiopia. And I thought that was extraordinary. Since I covered him every day, why wasn't I going? And when I asked, the first response was that he was going over the Christmas holidays, and they thought I would want to be home with my husband, who was covering the Boston Celtics, who are probably playing out of town. So he didn't work for the Boston Globe at the time, so that didn't seem like a likely explanation. And then the answer was, well, this other fellow has already gotten a visa, and it was a communist country. You couldn't get in. You won't be able to get in. So, you know, you have a choice at that moment. You can sort of accept the way things are, or you can decide to become a difficult woman. And I was a difficult woman at the Boston Globe. I don't think that there's anyone I ever worked for who would dispute that description. But I was difficult not because I'm not a nice person. I'm actually a really nice person. But I really don't like to get stepped on in that way. So I did what just seemed logical. I called the senator. I said, Senator, if I were to come off the plane with you, do you think the fact that I didn't have a visa would be an issue? And Senator Kennedy said, I do not think that that will be an issue. And when we got off the plane, he said, Mac, where are you? And he put his arm through mine, and we walked through customs, and it wasn't a problem. And I did some pretty good work in Ethiopia, so I'm glad I got a chance to go. And I think ultimately the Globe was glad that I went.
Eileen McNamara, former Boston Globe columnist and a professor emerita of the journalism program at Brandeis, and Margaret Sullivan, the first woman public editor at the New York Times, also served as a media columnist at the Washington Post. And you are listening to a special hour of Radio Boston with another conversation from the WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. In just a minute, we continue that conversation with how women journalists experience online hate, and then the funniest thing that happened to each of them in their careers. Stay tuned. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. And we're continuing our special hour of the show with the latest from the WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women, featuring in-depth conversations with women who have broken barriers in fields traditionally dominated by men. This time, it's all about journalism. Margaret Sullivan made several firsts in her career at the Buffalo News, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. And Eileen McNamara won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary after starting as a secretary at the Boston Globe. They've already told us about fighting for their places in an industry designed to exclude them and what's changing for women in the journalism industry today. Now we turn to the present and the challenges journalism faces in an era of online hate. I started by asking Margaret whether she's experienced that hatred and how it impacted her.
Well, I mean, I experienced it very directly as I was writing columns that had nothing to do with gender or being a woman. I would be attacked on social media, but also, you know, through phone calls, email, even in person, in a very sexualized, a very gender-driven way. You know, it would be about my body parts. And again, the subject matter had nothing to do with it. And, you know, that does get to you after a while. I found it very debilitating, and I didn't have the worst of it by any means. I mean, there are many, especially reporters, women reporters who cover tech, just get hammered and get doxxed. and have their lives ruined and their families' lives ruined.
So doxed is having their private information, their contact information, et cetera, made public. Right. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a very real thing, and it's also a part of what is so draining and so, you know, it can really knock you out. It's been a really tough time.
Eileen.
Well, I'm glad I'm not writing the column anymore in the Globe, because it was hard enough when it was email. There was a guy who used to call the Howie Carr show all the time on the radio, Jerry in the Car. And Jerry in the Car didn't like me very much, and neither did Howie, actually. I mean, my point of view about things. So I would hear Jerry in the Car, and then I would get a voicemail from Jerry in the Car. And they were all violent. They were all like rape threats. And I didn't get really, really nervous about it until it started to become a pattern. And this was, you know, there was a time when shock radio was a really big deal in Boston. It's not anymore, but it was. And there was another particularly vile shock jock in town who's no longer alive. May he not rest in peace. And he would name women journalists, especially women columnists. He would name us, and then these calls would come in all the time. And there was one guy that really scared me because he made reference in one phone call, he called repeatedly, to my mother's home address. Mm. You know, and, you know, the Globe called the state police. But I can't even imagine what it is like in the era of Twitter to be writing a political column. It just got to be horrific. And this doesn't happen to men in the same way. It just doesn't.
Margaret, one of the things that you pointed out in your book, you talked about the change when then-candidate Trump went out on the campaign trail. You talked about, for example, him calling out Katie Turr in I always think of it as the pit, right? The area for journalists. And there was this, has been this real turning on journalism.
Yeah.
And there is the trust dimension to that. And then there's the humanity dimension to that. Are we beginning to recover? And if not, you know, I'm hesitating because the things that I just called out, I'm not like blaming the victim, right? It's not Katie Turr's fault.
No.
But what do we need to do differently to continue to recover?
Yeah, I think one thing is that I don't believe that most newsroom leaders have a clue what it's like to be the people who are getting attacked. Like, they can understand it in an abstract way, but they don't know what it feels like. And it's pretty bad. So, I worry about that. I think it's really tough for them to truly grasp what they're asking their people, the world they're asking their people to sort of live in. One of the things Trump said, and he said this to Leslie Stahl of CBS, is the reason I disparage you people, meaning journalists, is so when you write a bad story about me, no one will believe it. I mean, you know, he master of saying the quiet part out loud, right? But, you know, that's a lot of what the disparagement of the press was all about. Make them look bad so that they're, you know, it cuts into credibility. So all of this stuff, the disparagement, the harassment, the, you know, online stuff, it's all very discouraging. And it makes it hard to do the job.
So, you know, you just talked about Leslie Stahl at CBS, Katie Turr, correspondent at NBC News. We do see a rising crop of more and more women out front in reporting, in journalism. And it takes me to another space that I want to talk about for just a minute. And I want to talk about white women. And here's a piece of what's on my mind with that. So this week, Nancy Barnes is named as the first woman editor of the Boston Globe. Maura Healey, who is white, is about to become the first elected female governor, and first out lesbian governor here in Massachusetts. We have 5 of our 6 statewide offices being held by women, most of them white. So we are in a moment where white women in particular are enfranchised and gaining power in very specific ways. You as a white woman breaking glass ceilings in news. we still, to some extent, have an old narrative that is white women have been oppressed. White women are fragile, right? Or white women have been stuck at home. And all of that has been true. But there is a new power for white women now. And criticism in feminism, in newsrooms, you know, that white women aren't using that power to bring up all women. As white women who are powerful, how do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that as news organizations have felt the pressure to diversify their ranks at the top, a relatively easy way to address that is to finally give a top role to a white woman. You know, there are lots of them that are at that secondary level. It's, you know, there's a comfort level. I think it's more challenging to have a leader who's a person of color, or an, you know, someone who is the other in some other way. So, you know, I'm glad to see the walls breaking down for white women, and I think it needs to spread and be different.
Eileen.
Yeah, it's great that women are getting elected to statewide office in Massachusetts, because God knows it's new. And a lot of those women are women of color. I mean, we have a black attorney general, and that's a good thing. And we have black women in our congressional delegation. We have an Asian woman who's the mayor of Boston. I mean, things are changing. They're changing really slowly, but they're changing. And I think you're going to see the same phenomenon. It's the pipeline that Margaret talked about. You know, the pipeline seems to take forever to spit people out, you know, into positions of power. But I think it's happening. You know, if you told me 10 years ago that we would have a landscape like this in Massachusetts, I would have laughed at you, because we are a really slow culture to change. And to share power. We are.
All right. One of the funniest moments in your career as a woman journalist. Whoever thinks of theirs first gets to go first.
Funniest. Well, I tell a story in my book about being at the New York Times and having a disagreement with Dean Baquet, who is the top editor of the New York Times. And he had misunderstood what I said I was going to write in a blog post, and he gave me a response, and you know, it was just a misunderstanding. We got our signals crossed, and when he saw it, he got angry, and he expressed his anger to me, and I pushed back and said, you know, no, you really can't talk to me that way, and he backed down, and soon showed up in my office with one of his deputies, looking kind of chagrined. And sorry that he had popped off. And he said to me in a moment that I can't forget, "Can you hug the public editor?" And now, there was nothing Me Too-ish about this, believe me. It was not that kind of thing. But it was a really weird line to hear. And I just sort of shrugged and said, don't worry about it, Dean. Everything's cool. And but it was a moment, and it was a definitely a memorable moment.
And it turns out you cannot hug
the
public editor.
No.
How about for you, Eileen? What one that just cracks you up?
Well, you know, because rage is sort of my go-to emotion. This is really funny in retrospect, but when I went to the Washington Bureau, I didn't have a desk. An office. Everybody else had an office, and all the other reporters. And there was a young man in one of the offices. They had a door and everything. And he was a correspondent for the paper. He wasn't on staff. So I said to the bureau chief, "Well, do you think we could ask him maybe to sit in the hall here where you've put a desk for me?" Because I'm having this experience that's happening every day, which is when the FedEx man comes, who do you think he goes to? And I said, you know, he's a very nice man, but I don't want to keep signing for FedEx envelopes. So maybe you could ask the correspondent to sit out here, because I bet he won't come to him to get him to sign for these packages. I said, "Oh, no, we couldn't possibly do that. And, you know, he's been with us for a really long time. And I said, "So you're going to leave me in the hall." And I covered the hill. So I had a desk in the House Press gallery, in the Center Press gallery, so I didn't have to be in the office. But it started to really bug me. So after a while, I did go in and complain about it again. And the next thing I knew, they were building a wall around my desk. And my bureau chief came in and said, "We're even going to give you a door. Are you happy? Have you pulled yourself up by your pantyhose?" Oh. And I thought, see, I said it wasn't completely funny. And I did wear pantyhose back then. But that's the kind of thing that wouldn't happen now. You wouldn't tell you're the only female news reporter in the Washington Bureau to pull herself up by her pantyhose.
Although the walling you in thing is a little bit funny.
The wall is pretty funny. It is pretty funny.
So we have an audience question that sort of channels the direction that one should go with the last question. So let's look at this one. What one piece of advice do you have for young journalists who are trying to break into the world of media, namely female journalists? And I know we have a number of young people here in the room tonight. So Eileen, I'll mix it up. I'll start with you this time.
Just be persistent. There's really no substitute for hard work. And there's just no substitute for believing in yourself. And there'll be lots of times where people will try to erode that confidence. And none of us are really that confident. I think most female journalists I know have this really tough persona, but they're kind of mushy in the middle because it takes just a lot of energy to have that persona. Just work really hard. And if it means that you have to work harder than everybody else, it sucks, but so what? Work harder than everybody else, and you'll get there. When I was answering Bob Phelps's office, good morning, Robert Phelps' office, may I help you, in the Globe newsroom, I never for a minute thought I was going to stay in that chair. And I think the conviction that I was not going to stay in that chair got me out of that chair.
Mm-hmm. Margaret.
I would say to get great reporting experience, that there is no substitute for covering a beat, putting yourself in a position where you're doing the basics of journalism. Like, don't come out of J school or start your career thinking that you're going to be an opinion writer or an essayist or something. Do the work of being a reporter. And as Eileen said, those years she had as a reporter served her so well when she did get to be a columnist. I think that everybody who is going to have a great career in journalism needs to have that foundation. So go get it at the beginning.
Margaret Sullivan is a journalist who started at the Buffalo News and went on to the New York Times and the Washington Post. Her new memoir is Newsroom Confidential, Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life. And Eileen McNamara of the Boston Globe. She worked her way up from secretary to columnist, reporting all around the world all along the way. She's now professor emerita in the journalism program at Brandeis University. We hope you've enjoyed these excerpts from my conversations with them at WBUR City Space as part of the Phenomenal Women series. And that's our show for today. Thank you for listening.